Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
It's 1851. I remember it well. The Industrial Revolution is raging. Everything is in flux and flow as new technologies reshape the world. And we're right at the heart of it all here in London. But we're not inside a factory or inside the boiler of a steam engine. We're somewhere very, 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 very small. Completely dark. Surrounded by the most intricate mechanisms in creation. Everything is quiet, apart from a very gentle scratching. As something searches inside this space for a catch. Hours pass. Springs are slowly tested and released, tested and held. And then, all of a sudden, click, the lock opens. And we see the lock picker, an American who's come across the world to take on this challenge, who has spent days inside this room. The news spreads downstairs to the lockmaker's shop and out into the streets. Newspapers carry the story out across the country, across the world to engineers and capitalists. Under the headline, The Great Lock Controversy, is the news that the Brahma lock, the machine that promised perfect security, has been beaten. The unpickable lock has been picked. Hello and welcome once again to another episode of Patented with me, Dallas Campbell. It's a podcast about the history of invention from History Hit. And today we're talking about locks. What was the first lock, the first padlock, the first lock that involved a key? Well, my guest today is a historian of locks, amongst other things, David Churchill from the University of Leeds. And at the heart of our chat today is a story that I certainly hadn't heard before, and perhaps you hadn't either, the Great Lock Controversy of 1851. It's a story about locks and a time when technology promised to change the world in a profound way by creating a sense of perfect security. Sound familiar? Hi, David. How are you?
I'm good, thank you, Dallas. How are you?
I'm all right. Did I read this right? Are you a historian of locks?
I am. Yeah, amongst other things.
How the hell does one... Like, when I was at school, you know, and you do your careers advice, we had this computer and you tapped in, you know, you had to answer... This is like 1988. And you tapped in answers to things and it said what you're going to be when you grow up. And I got, like, priest and stuff. But I don't remember ever there being a lock historian, because I'd be like, that's what I want to do.
Absolutely, right? Yeah, I know. I did the same thing. I got helicopter pilot and undertaker. So
similar,
you know,
both.
Yeah,
like there's a synergy there. There's a connection.
Yeah, but I'm basically historian of locks and most things security.
Interesting. And why? Okay, just before we start, how did you get interested? Was there a thing that was like, got it, it's locks?
Yeah, so basically my early research was on the history of policing, and I was interested there not just in what the police did, but also what ordinary people did to deal with crime in their everyday lives. And that kind of led me to locks. And I was like, oh, these people, you know, there are these new locks around in the Victorian period and, you know, be interesting to know more about them. And then, yeah, then I found this like wonderful archive of the Chubb Company. And then I've been at it ever since, really.
So was it that you, when you were sort of looking at that, was it that you found interesting stories that you thought, oh my God, who knew? Was it that?
Yeah, it was. And it was also, I suppose, just the idea. It seemed to me that this was around about the time that people were starting to think of technology as something that could help solve the problem of crime. And I thought, oh, that's an interesting little line of inquiry. I'll see where that leads me. And yeah, it's led me through locks and safes and strong rooms and burglar alarms. And
what about internet security? Because I just got hacked this morning.
Oh, no.
I'm really annoyed.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I kind of decided in the end that I was going to draw the line at around about the time the internet got going, partly because it's just a whole other thing.
Sorry, listener. I'm moaning and we'll crack on. Okay, locks. I'm excited to hear about some of these exciting stories. We're going to get on to the Victorians. It always comes down to the Victorians in the end. Let's go all the way back. Is there such a thing as the first lock or lock 1.0? You know, I tell you what I imagine. You know that very famous photograph of Tutankhamun's tomb, and it's the door, and it's, I guess, Howard Carter, someone with him took this photograph, and it's of the locked door, and there's a kind of bar across it, and there's a seal, and it hasn't been opened since, you know, whenever Tutankhamun was locked. That image is filled with kind of like, oh my God, an unpicked lock, you know, what could lie behind it? And there's something rather amazing and wonderful about that. Is that the first lock, that type of era, or can we go even further?
Yeah, well, you're not far off. I mean, people start getting interested in the history of locks in the 19th century, and yeah, they tend to trace it back to ancient Egypt. That's their kind of first point where they can say, because they always say things like, you know, in their language, you know, primitive man buried his treasure in the ground, you know. So security, if you like, is kind of anthropological. It goes right back.
Yeah.
But in terms of something that's kind of like a fairly elaborate device that would be used to secure a door, a chest, or somewhere that you don't want other people to get into, then yeah, they head back to ancient Egypt, which had some of these very big locks that were sort of within like the bolt of a door. So we're talking like a big piece of wood, like 3, 4, 5 feet, and with this like enormous like wooden key that you'd kind of put in. The principle was actually quite advanced.
But was it a mechanical thing, like as we might imagine, you put a key in and turn it? And
yeah, it's not exactly turning it. It's more a bit like it's almost kind of like raking it in a way. Like it's a big long wooden stick, but it has little sort of, you know, it's obviously designed to fit the lock inside. And really, I mean, that's the, in some ways, the kind of principle of the sort of modern Yale pin tumbler lock that's invented in the mid 19th century, or it kind of rediscovers that principle almost without knowing it.
And do those ancient Egyptian or that period, are there examples of it?
Well, there's not many because they were made of wood. There's not many. So most of the locks that survive and that people were collecting at the time were locks from medieval, early modern Europe, which were made in iron or brass or other metal or whatever. And so those are the ones that you tend to see. But yeah, but they do trace back other kinds of locks to, yeah, ancient Egypt, ancient Greece, ancient Rome, and so on.
And what, I mean, those particular locks, were they, are we going to get into sort of lock picking in a moment, but were they, like, how secure were they? I mean, did they stop people stealing things or?
Yeah, it's difficult to know. I mean, the evidence base is pretty fragmentary, obviously, the further back you go. But they were, you know, they were quite elaborate pieces of kit. But certainly with the kind of ancient Egyptian lock, there's no doubt that you know the guy who's going around with the key because it's just so enormous. So it's not very secret in that way.
I always lose my keys.
Yeah.
I always lose them. That's what I need is just a big...
Yeah, well, you wouldn't lose this, that's for sure. But yeah, so in some ways they're quite crude, but the actual kind of mechanism and the kind of security thinking behind it is pretty sophisticated and pretty advanced. And yeah, I mean, it probably did, along with other things, deter people from having a go at trying to get in places where they weren't wanted.
Suddenly, just as you said that, I just imagined the opening of the first Indiana Jones movie, where he goes into the cave and there's all kinds of security booby traps and arrows flying along and death traps and a giant ball rolling. I guess that's kind of a key. In a way. Did those sort of puzzle key type things exist? Is that a thing, or was that just in movies?
No. Well, they do exist. I mean, how far back these go is a bit tricky. But certainly, I mean, approaching the kind of time that we're coming on to talk about, around about, you know, the 17th, 18th century, there are like what people at the time tended to call letter locks, a bit like combination locks, basically. You know, you spell out the code word. And so there's a certain amount of puzzle or mystery to that. And then some locks also around about that time have somehow a little puzzle in them. So there's a famous lock by a Birmingham maker called John Wilkes, which is in the Victoria and Albert Museum in London. And it's got on the front of the lock case, it's got like a little figure of a guy, but there's like a hidden catch somewhere. And if you press that, then he kicks his foot and then the keyhole's behind that.
See, that's the thing. That, there is something really lovely about that. I love that idea of kind of puzzles and kind of weird things or a kind of book that you pull from the shelf and suddenly the door, the wall opens. I always thought when I own a house, I do own a house. What am I talking about? I'm going to have like a secret room with a book that you pull.
Yeah, it'd be good, wouldn't it? I mean, there'd be all kinds of stuff you could stash in there. Yeah.
Yeah. I love that. Okay. So early locks made of wood. Okay. Got it. Take us through, I suppose, where do we start the locks as we might recognize them? Industrial Revolution, Victorian times, where do you like to kind of...
Yeah, so, I mean, let's go a little before that in a sense of just setting the scene. So by the sort of, well, medieval, early modern period, so we're talking now, you know, 16th, 17th, 18th centuries, most locks in Europe, you know, they're kind of metal locks. They've got keys. We'd kind of recognize roughly what's going on there. But they do have a different kind of design principle from most of the locks we have today. Those kinds of locks at that time were made with fixed guards or wards in them.
Mm-hmm. What does that mean?
So, yeah. So
I push a key in. What's happening?
So you push the key in, and then as you try to turn the key has to pass over a little shape. If you can imagine like a little shape that's kind of that extends. So the key has to pass over that little obstacle. So if you look at keys to lots of old locks, more or less elaborately, you'll see there's a little shape cut out of the bit at the end of the key. And that's because that's the shape that it has to pass over inside the lock. Right. So that's the kind of basis for those locks around about that time. And they're still very common through the 19th century, partly because they're quite cheap to make, you know, have a sand set of patterns and you kind of bash them out in the dozens.
If there was a set of patterns, does that mean if you had enough keys, you could like pick a lock easily or just like open? Or, I mean, how secure were those locks?
So you're getting to the heart of the problem, right? So one of the main problems of these kinds of locks was what was duplication. So yeah, if your locksmiths have 20 or 30 patterns, then every 20th or 30th lock they produce is going to fit, you know, the same key as the one before that and one before that and so on. So if you collect 20 or 30 keys with these kinds of patterns, you can get into a lot of doors, right? So that's the problem. And people by the sort of later 18th century, they're well aware of this. They're well aware that this is a problem. And they start trying to think about ways to overcome this problem. And so it's that period, the kind of classic Industrial Revolution period, the late 18th and the early 19th century, when we do start to see the kinds of locks that will become the basis for kind of modern locks.
And was there, I mean, you mentioned sort of Chubb. When I think of locks, I think of Chubb. That seemed to be the big, is that them? Are they, I'm just trying to imagine the Industrial Revolution with building steam engines and cotton gins and stuff. I've never really considered locks as being part of that kind of revolution of things.
Yeah, exactly. So they are very much part of that. And people at the time do refer to locks sometimes as machines, which is very weird from our point of view. But just as they thought the steam engine was a machine and just as they thought all these other revolution technologies are machines, sometimes they talk about locks as machines too. And yeah, Chubb are part of that. Originally, they're a firm of like ship engineers or ship outfitters in Portsmouth around the kind of naval dockyard there. But the story goes that there was a spate of robberies in this dockyard and the government issued a reward, a prize, for somebody who could invent a lock that would basically have a unique key that could be produced at an affordable price. And so that's what stimulates them to go into inventing locks around about 1818. And then they develop that over the next few years. But I mean, the forerunners of this were a little further back, about a generation further back. And we're looking there at a couple of people, but particularly Joseph Brammer, who's a kind of prodigious inventor and engineer.
Well, yeah, I've heard of Brammer because he invented the toilet, because I think we did an episode on it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, water closets, fountain pens, presses, printing machines. He does all kinds of things, basically.
But he's one of those Victorian industrialists who kind of came up with everything at the time. So I didn't realize he made locks as well.
Yeah, he did. So his lock was one of his earlier inventions. This is in the 1780s. So by this point, he's moved down from Yorkshire and is in London, and he's a fellow of the Society of Arts. And so he's involved in the world of, you know, mechanics, inventors and engineers. And he invents a lock. There had been various inventions previous to this and attempts to kind of produce a better lock on more secure principles. But he invents really the first one, which is like seen to be really revolutionary in terms of its potential for security. And this is his, you know, Brammer's lock is just how it's known.
What does it look like? Is it a lock that goes on a door, or is it padlock?
So it's a lock that can go on a door. It's a lock that you could fit to a chest or a box or whatever. I think they were used for sometimes used for the red boxes, like government information boxes, government papers. Yeah. You could have it on your door, on your office, or on a drawer, wherever you want to fit it, really. What does it look like? The lock itself, you know, outwardly doesn't look like very much. It has a kind of circular keyhole. The key is kind of interesting. It's like quite a small key, and it's kind of cylindrical shaped, and it's got at the end of it lots of little cuts in the cylinder. And what it does, basically how it works, you push the key in to the keyhole, and those cuts then apply differential pressure to lots of little sliders, little bits of metal that are in the lock. So you push the key in against a spring, and it pushes each of these sliders, which are, so to speak, intersecting the bolt. And so it pushes them all back just the right amount so that once they're clear, then the bolt can move. And the clever thing about it is that if you were able to get in the lock and look at these sliders at the front, they all just look like they're in the same position. So you wouldn't be able to tell outwardly how far you need to push them. The secret, if you like, is in the key. And Brammer's lock and others around that time, and all the kind of ones that we're going to talk about that came afterwards, they all work on this new principle, which is not that the key has to pass a fixed guard or a fixed ward, but that it has to manipulate moving parts within the lock.
So pushing little pins inside.
Yeah, like it's like pushing little like metal pins back to the right amount, or it's lifting little metal levers or tumblers up, which are like little thin plates of metal within the lock. So they all have to instead engage and manipulate just right these moving parts. And if they do that, then that will free the bolt to move.
And was in terms of security, was this a massive leap in the technology?
It was, because it counteracted a few problems of the old warded locks. So the first one we touched upon already is duplication. So if you've got 20 or 30 patterns, every 20th or 30th lock is going to have, you know, be the same as the last batch. But with this way of looking at things, then you can make very, very tiny gradations of difference in those cuts in the key, in the case of Brammer's, or in the key bit for like a Chubb-style lock, so it lifts the tumbler just slightly higher or slightly lower. And so you can have a much greater range of combinations, if you like, or a much greater range of permutations for the same size of lock and key. You know, and the more moving pieces you put in, the more you get. Right. And at the time, lock inventors loved these tables where they kind of show this exponential effect that, you know, if you put a few moving parts in, then you can maybe get whatever, you know, 60, 70 combinations. But if you put like 10 in, then you're going to be into like billions and billions. You know, it's an exponential series in that way.
I'm Tristan Hughes, host of The Ancients from History Hit, where twice a week, every week, we delve into our ancient past. I'm joined by leading experts, academics, and authors who share incredible stories from our distant history and shine a light on some of antiquity's great questions. Was the Oracle of Delphi really able to see into the future? What can be discovered from lost civilizations? And was King Arthur actually real? You can expect all of this and more from The Ancients on History Hit wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Presumably with lock manufacturers, there's an arms race develops between lock manufacturers and thieves. You know, if people could pick the old lock with the kind of shape that passed over a thing. So when this new lock came out, were people like, right, how are we gonna crack this one?
So the lock manufacturers certainly make a lot of this. I mean, even in Brammer's original patent specifications or whatever in the 1780s, he's talking about artful thieves, ingenious thieves, and that's why we need these new locks. These were actually really quite good locks made like this were really difficult to pick. There's not a lot of stories of criminals opening these kinds of locks. There are stories of criminals stealing the keys and copying them, but not of picking them without access to the keys.
I think it was Chubb or one of these companies who kind of offered a criminal or somebody who is in prison, if they could pick the lock, they would be released. That's how confident they were of this new type of lock. Or maybe I dreamt that.
No. So this is a story which is very often repeated by Chubb for decades and centuries afterwards. Is that in the 1820s, basically, Chubb from fairly early on had quite close relationships with people in power, and somehow, apparently, they managed to arrange that, like, some legendary lockpick who was imprisoned on a hulk, a convict ship in the 1820s, would have a go picking their lock. Allegedly, if he'd opened it, then he'd have his freedom. And he had it for a number of weeks. And in the end, allegedly, he threw it away and said, just take the damn thing out. You know, I'm sick of it.
It sounds apocryphal. It sounds like that story may be absolute.
Maybe something like that happened. I mean, they certainly embellished it over the years. You know, it got more and more elaborate.
It's one of those stories that's too good to check. We'll just
absolutely.
But was there an idea at that time that there was this idea of perfect security of like, that's it, we've got it cracked?
Yeah, exactly. These new locks, that's really what their makers claim for them. It's not just that they're way more secure than the old ones, but that really we've reached a new age in security and we've reached a point where really our locks are unpickable. And that's a claim that's made certainly of Brammer's lock. So sometime around about 1790, he puts his lock in his shop window in Piccadilly in London with a message on it that basically says, whoever can pick this lock, or accurately, whoever can fashion an instrument to pick this lock will get 200 guineas. 200 pounds is a lot of money. And that challenge is apparently unmet until 1851. So they're seen as being so unlikely to pick that you would really wager a lot on that.
I like that. It's a bit like an X Prize, you know. It's like if you can go into space and come back, and, you know, in a reusable rocket, we'll give you £1 million. I love that, the lock X Prize. So 1851. Well, 1851. Great Exhibition, I think, isn't it? At Crystal Palace.
Yeah. So there's the Great Exhibition, Crystal Palace. And this is, you know, it's quite a famous event. It's sort of seen in some ways as a celebration of the kind of preeminence of British manufacturing and British industry. So it's an international trade fair. Everyone brings their inventions and artifacts and designs and decorative materials and whatever. It's a great big thing. And one of the things that is exhibited is locks. Grammer's lock is there, and Chubb's detector lock is there, and various other locks are on display. But someone's kind of come along to spoil the party, if you like. This chap is Alfred Charles Hobbs. He's an American. He's the agent for an American lock firm called Day and Newell, which is one of the kind of big names in American lock making. And he's a very skilled mechanic. And he comes along and claims that he is going to show the shortcomings or the flaws in British locks as a way of promoting his employer's lock. And so what happens basically is that he first picks the Chubb detector lock. He picks it first in private, but then he demonstrates it in public. Picks it fairly quickly, within about half an hour or something.
How does he pick it?
Right, okay. So he has this method, which comes to be called the tentative method, lock picking. So basically, what he does is he puts pressure on the bolt. He has a little device which keeps pressure on the bolt free for his hands. And then he has little, you know, lock picks, little pieces of metal. And he individually moves the moving parts inside until he can feel some sort of release in pressure on them. And that's the point when, that should be the point when they've reached the height that they're supposed to be lifted to by the key, right? The clever thing really was implying a pressure to the bolt, because otherwise you can't really feel this release in pressure, and otherwise you kind of, each time that you do one, then it just drops back to where it was. So it's a way of kind of being able to manipulate these things individually and sequentially until you've got them all in the right place. So he does that with Chubb's lock, and that's seen to be a success. Chubb write letters to the press contesting it and saying, oh, this wasn't one of our latest and all the rest of it. But most people...
I'm interested, just because of the period, and here's an American coming over and making fun of the British lock, was there a kind of political sort of one-upmanship?
There was, yeah.
Because this unpickable lock had suddenly been...
Yeah, picked. Certainly. So certainly it's a surprise, right? The people, people writing about this think this is a surprise. There's also definitely a sort of patriotic element to some of the discussion. I mean, it's a bit complicated. So some newspapers are kind of very impressed, and they think this is good because this is progress. You know, this is someone coming along and getting us to kind of buck up our ideas. And soon, I'm sure some, you know, Chubb or someone will improve the lock and it will be progress. Others are a little bit more skeptical about his methods in a way which is a bit more prejudiced or a bit more jaundiced. And there's a lot, you know, Punch have this poem about Yankeedom coming over and showing up British inventions. And this isn't actually just about Hobbs and locks. It's actually a theme of the Great Exhibition. So new American, like, reaping machines and harvesting, Colt revolvers are exhibited. All these things are seen to be better than British inventions. So it's sort of slightly undercutting the idea or the assumption of British supremacy in inventions. So anyway, so once Hobbs is done with the detector lock, Chubb's lock, he then moves on to Brammer's lock. This one is much more complicated. It takes a very long time, many, many days, many, many hours of working a couple of hours a day on this thing in private. But eventually it is opened. And there was an agreement beforehand that he could pick it in this way. And there was a jury composed to, so to speak, verify what happened. And they're happy that he's picked it. And so there's a little bit of noises off in the press, but basically it's seen that he has picked this, albeit under very special conditions.
It seems like if he's doing it in private, he could just cheat and just get the key.
Yeah, well,
I've picked it, but no one saw. So I kind of think if there's no evidence, then it's like...
Yeah, so he has to explain how he's done it, and they inspect the lock afterwards, and they see that there are little scratches on it, which are consistent with what he's saying his method is. So they're reasonably sure that they know, you know, he's being straight about it.
Just while we're on lock picking, can we just clear a few things up? You know, in like the movies, James Bond or whatever, and they've got handcuffed together, and then he gets a hairpin and sort of puts a bend in the hairpin and starts fiddling about. Is that, can you do that? Or a hairpin or a bit of wire and they scrabble around and learn.
I mean, it depends kind of what lock is, right? I mean, over the years, obviously, some locks are produced to a good standard and some locks aren't, and that's never changed, right? So if you get a lock which is, you know, very basic or whatever, then if you're lucky, a bit of jimmying around with a pin or a paperclip might do the trick. Generally speaking, though, not really. For anything that's decent, you need something like what he was doing. You need some sort of continual pressure, some sort of specialist equipment, and you need a bit of still space to do that.
My friend Will, when I was at school with him. I went to boarding school, so apologies. And he had a tuck box. Sorry, that sounds terribly ridiculous.
No worries. No judgment to Will.
But he had food in it, and he had a padlock on it, and I could pick it with a tweezers. And I did it because I'd seen it in the movies. You know, you shove a bit of wire in. And I tried it. I had a pair of tweezers, and I shoved it in. And lo and behold, the thing opened. I used to steal all his food and then lock it
there
again.
There we go. Did he know? Have you just revealed this for the first
time? No, I don't think he ever knew. But I was careful. I didn't take all the food. I just would just, you know, take...
You're judicious about it. Yeah, absolutely.
Pepperami sausages, I remember he had. Ooh.
Yeah. Well, that takes me back.
Sorry, Will. And then actually just while I'm on this, you know, in combination locks with a dial and sometimes they have a stethoscope. Is that true?
No. No, that one is a kind of invention of the movies in a way.
Okay, we can move on. I just suddenly had these images of lock picking in
movies.
It's
one of those things that there's lots of interviews with like lock and safe companies in the British press by about the 1920s, 1930s, and they delight in puncturing this myth over and over again. Yeah.
But that okay, so we're at the 1851, we're at Crystal Palace, the Great Exhibition. Was that really the foundation of modern locks? Did that kind of like light the touch paper, as it were, do you think?
Yeah, in some ways it did, I think. I mean, it was kind of, I mean, obviously, so names like Brammer and Chubb were well-known kind of household names before this, but this was in some ways the moment that really ignited the kind of wider public imagination about locks and security. It's the first time that lots of, you know, big mainstream newspapers at the time, like the, you know, the Times or the Illustrated London News or whatever, were devoting serious amount of space talking about locks and all these kind of, you know, the technicalities of all of what we've been talking about. And it really did inspire, you know, a lot of inventive activity in lockmaking to try to produce a lock that was actually unpickable, to try to get around this new method that Hobbs had exhibited.
So new technology rather than just brute force in keeping things secure.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think this period is really interesting because it is a period in which people start to think that, okay, technologies could really play a major role. Like, yeah, as you say, kind of well thought out, well designed mechanical kind of artifice could play a real role in helping to protect people against crime. And that's something that bleeds over also into the kind of making of so-called burglar-proof safes at this time and other things. It's interesting as well because it comes at a moment which is about a generation or so after the so-called new police forces were established in England in the 1820s, 1830s onwards. Comes also about a generation or two after all the experiments with, you know, new prisons and penitentiaries. By this time, people are starting to kind of think that these things were maybe not quite all they were made out to be. In terms of reforming criminals and preventing them from committing crime in the first place. And so if you like, they kind of move on to kind of, if you like, hard technologies like these as something which might be the kind of basic kind of founding stone in protecting modern society from the risk of crime and thieves.
When I look at my keys now, you know, I've got like the Yale's type key for like a Yale lock. I guess that's the other big company. And I've got a Chubb style lock, which is the kind of long bit. They don't look that much different from the locks that you've been describing. They seem to pretty much work. I mean, is there any kind of lock technology now? Is there such a thing as an unpickable lock? Are there lock picking competitions? Like, where is the world of locks now?
I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, your keys tell you that, you know, the principles of kind of modern locks are direct descendants of the kinds of period that we're talking about. And of course, you know, there've been lots of innovations in how they're made and so on at scale and more cheaply and so on. But the basic founding point of the design is a direct inheritance from this kind of period. In terms of what changes over time, in terms of lock technologies, I suppose there's a bit of a change in the sort of later 20th century when it's not so much a change away from locks as a kind of new ideas of what locks and keys could be. So we can start seeing, you know, like electronic kind of access cards and things, you know, the magnetic strip as being a way to get into something which is not using a key. Obviously, nowadays, we have obviously smart locks as well and other things like that, which potentially open up new directions in terms of how security might work. But there absolutely is still lock picking competitions that go on. there are lock picks and lock picking guides are widely available. Yeah.
Is there such a thing as a skeleton key? I remember as a kid hearing the term skeleton key and thinking, wow, that's great, because it's I thought a skeleton, I thought kind of Scooby-Doo. Yeah. But are there kind of keys that you can get that would open anything? Or is that a kind of myth as well?
I think it's a bit of a myth. There are obviously like master key systems, like what, you know, you would have used when all hotels had keys, you know, that you can suite keys in such a way that one key will open a certain set, but it won't open anything beyond that. The original talk about skeletoning keys and stuff goes back to those kind of earlier warded locks we were talking about before. It's a kind of key that will bypass the wards or the guards in the lock. So you don't need to try to make a key that has exactly the same shape. You have to have it that it's just so that it hooks around or it bypasses the guards in some way so that it can directly act on the bowl. There is some truth in that, but in terms of more sophisticated lock designs, then that becomes much more challenging.
I'm never going to, next time I lose my keys, I'm going to not be frustrated and angry. I'm going to celebrate the key. I'm going to, I had a wonderful conversation with David and we talked about the history of the lock. And David, thank you so much. Really fascinating conversation. Thank you very much for taking the time. I don't know what a busy lock historian does all day, whatever you do all day. Thank you for taking the time out of your day to come on the show.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That's it for locks. Don't forget to lock your front door when you leave your house. Thank you very, very much for listening. Don't forget, if you're enjoying the show, don't forget to go and listen to other episodes. Tell all your friends about it. Don't forget to hit subscribe or whatever one has to do to satisfy the voracious appetite of the algorithm. And don't forget as well to get in touch if you've got a suggestion for a topic or a story that you'd like us to cover. You can email us at patented@historyhit.com. Or you can prod and poke me, or pick me even, on social media.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
While I still have you, very briefly, if you fancy getting all of the History Hit podcast archive and new episodes ad-free, along with hundreds of history documentaries to watch, download our app across Apple App Store, Google Play, and smart TV platforms. Follow the link in the show notes or go to historyhit.com/subscribe. There is thousands of hours of history on there, including a documentary on science in the Middle Ages with Seb Volk, and also one with me talking about the secret history of the space race. As a Patented listener, you get a special gift if you use the code PATENTED at the checkout. You get 50% off your first 3 months. That's PATENTED for 50% off your first 3 months. And if you're an Apple listener, you can subscribe for new ad-free podcast episodes within the Apple app.